land, resources, and treaty rights.
So these lines on the landscape, redrawing spaces of health, seems to me one of the fundamental changes, at least.
A roundtable discussion about health and environmental issues in the history of Aboriginal peoples of Canada. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 32 of Nature's Past, the second part of our special series, Histories of Canadian Environmental Issues. So, on this month's episode, we're thinking about health and environmental issues in Aboriginal history in Canada. And we're joined again by our assistant producers, Stacey Nation-Knapper and Andrew Watson. Hello to the both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Aboriginal health and environmental issues in Canadian history have obviously come into the news recently. We're approaching the one-year anniversary of the state of emergency that was declared by the Attawapiskat First Nation last year in November, I believe. The nation declared the state of emergency over a problem with shelter and housing. Stacey, can you tell us a little bit about what happened last year during that particular controversy?
Sure. There were some buildings on reserve that had been deemed unfit for people to live in and had been closed, and others had been overcrowded and people were asked to leave them. And this left members of the community homeless and without homes. And so some were living in tents, some were living in various forms of tents, had moved to other homes, causing more crowding issues in other parts of the community. And so the local community leader asked for help to ameliorate the situation for the community.
Because, of course, the real crisis was that winter was coming.
Yes.
Attawapiskat's reserve is located right up on the shores of James Bay in northern Ontario. So it's an environment that most southern Ontarians are unfamiliar with. But we can imagine, of course, that the winter weather conditions are considerably more severe than they are here in Toronto. So this, of course, caused enormous controversy for the province of Ontario, and particularly for the federal government. Andrew, can you tell us a little bit about what the federal government's response was?
Sure. Well, this is a really important point, because it wasn't just an isolated discussion about this one community. It became a larger discussion about how both the federal and provincial governments relate to these First Nations, and not just housing. Housing was the main issue, but it brought in all sorts of issues related to particularly federal funding for First Nations reserves, mm-hmm. and whether or not these remote and isolated communities were getting the appropriate attention from the federal government and the resources they need to actually provide a quality of life that's commensurate with the rest of Canada. This is why the history is so important, because it brought up this sort of same context, the same relationship between First Nations communities on reserve and government policy and government mentalities towards these communities, mm-hmm. that has been happening for the last at least 100 or 120 years. At least.
Right, and it directly brought up the sort of a reflection of the past relationships between the federal government and First Nations in Canada, particularly through Indian agents. The federal government's response to the crisis last year was to put some money forward to provide for the construction of 20 new houses, but at the same time, a third-party intermediary was sent on the part of the federal government to audit the spending of the Attawapiskat First Nation. Stacey, what was the problem with that approach?
As we talked about before we started the conversation this morning, harken back to the idea of an Indian agent, the person who comes in and acts as the, in theory, intermediary between the government and the First Nations groups, but who is anything but
neutral.
Yes, thank you. Neutral in the situation. I think, too, one of the other things that I was thinking about with this was the role of the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, mm-hmm. in this, in what was happening in Attawapiskat, because this particular corporation has plans to build more duplexes in Attawapiskat, mm-hmm. But it's being held up by bureaucratic speed bumps, essentially, which is similar to the situation with the third party intermediary, in that by imposing these bureaucratic loops or hoops for Indigenous communities to jump through, the solution to the problem is being delayed. Mm-hmm. And communities are now going into their second year of not having enough housing for their community members because they have these bureaucratic hoops to jump through, and because these intermediaries aren't being seen as impartial mediators.
And the Attawapiskat First Nation resisted this audit, because of course the implication, and in some sense not even implication, explicit purpose or the explicit message was that the First Nation had mismanaged funds.
Their earlier funds, the funds that they were given originally.
Right.
They said, well, the federal government said, well, we gave you all this money. What have you done with it?
$90 million.
Why haven't you spent it properly? And so, again, the explicit assumption there, which has all these, you know, antecedents, is that the First Nations are incapable of spending the money appropriately when it's given to them by the federal government. And what's new in this particular situation is we see in the media all the fallout is that much more apparent to the Canadian public about what happens when this dynamic between the federal government and the First Nations goes awry. Yeah.
And I think there were two really interesting twists to the story. The first, of course, the initial implication was that Attawapiskat had mismanaged federal funds. And as it turned out, they hadn't. In fact, the many tens of millions of dollars that the federal cabinet had claimed had been sent to Attawapiskat weren't just for housing. And it seemed to overlook the fact that that money is intended to cover everything from healthcare to education to housing to the entire governance of the nation. And so there was sort of the implication that somehow a lot of money was only earmarked for housing, which wasn't the case. Right. And second to that, as it turned out, sending a third party was a violation of the agreement between the nation and the federal government, which was determined by a federal court recently in the late summer.
There's an underlying paternalism. It's not a new paternalism. This underlying paternalism of the Canadian government, and in large part, larger Canadian society to an extent, who may not know as much about federal and First Nations policy, about how funds are managed. And when the numbers are thrown around in the press and we see, oh, these millions of dollars already went to the community, they were mismanaged. And then there's this underlying bedrock of paternalism that has been evident for the history of Canada, this idea that, well, what did they do with it? Why isn't it being handled properly, without really trying to understand what's happening within communities? And so historically, I think that that's important, too, to know that this is something that's gone on for centuries.
And there are all these health side effects to the situation, the fallout with housing in particular, and not just housing, but general infrastructure. Water quality as well has been a longstanding issue for First Nations communities in the isolated areas. And the media attention that this tends to get is now spilling out of Canada's borders, and Canada is starting to get a reputation of an inability to properly look after their indigenous population, and this calls into question how can the central government that's in Ottawa or Toronto properly govern or work with these First Nations that live in isolated communities, that live in very remote territories, and sort of bring into some questions about how honest are the governments being with solving these problems, and how much of it is sort of Band-Aid solutions and overlooking some of the pitfalls and repercussions of a very long and historic mismanagement.
So I think for this episode, we definitely need to know a little bit more about the historical relationship between the federal government in Ottawa and First Nations of Canada, certainly. But there's another twist to the story of Attawapiskat, in that there's a fairly significant diamond mine in the traditional territory of the First Nation, the De Beers Diamond Mine, the Victor Diamond Mine, on the doorstep of the reserve. And so there's this longer history of the relationship between First Nations and industrial exploitation of natural resources in Canada, certainly. And I think there are numerous cases we can think of industrial pollution of reserves as a consequence of the exploitation of natural resources, whether it's forestry, whether it's mineral resources or hydroelectric resources. And then there's this question about who benefits from those natural resources when they're exploited? Is it De Beers deriving the most benefit? Is it the province of Ontario getting royalties from the resources on traditional Attawapiskat land? Or does the First Nation get those resources? And this, of course, I think came up in the debate as well. But as historians, we know this isn't a new story. This has happened in the past. So we probably should talk to some historians who've looked at health and environmental issues in the history of Aboriginal peoples in Canada.
I'm Stacey Nation Knapper. I'm a third-year doctoral student in history at York University.
My name is Leanne Luddy. I'm Anishinaabe Kwe from the Serpent River First Nation, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of History at Memorial University.
Hi, I'm Maureen Lux. I teach Canadian history, history of medicine, and Aboriginal history at Brock University.
I'm Kristen Burnett. I teach Canadian history, health history, colonial settler history in the Indigenous Learning Department at Lakehead University.
Hi there, I'm Jocelyn Thorpe, and I am in Women and Gender Studies at the University of Manitoba.
I'm Brittany Luby. I am a doctoral candidate at York University and a Treaty 3 girl.
We have a very big panel today, which I think is an especially fantastic treat for listeners for our roundtable here on health and environmental issues in Aboriginal history. I want to thank everyone for joining us today to talk about the ways in which health and environmental issues intersect with Aboriginal history. And I thought a good way maybe to start would be to get everybody to tell listeners a little bit about your own research interests and the way in which your research addresses either health and environmental issues in Aboriginal history or both. And maybe we can start with Maureen.
Thanks, Sean. My research addresses the Canadian state's colonial policies and practices and their impact on Aboriginal health. It examines the treaty-making era, so the 1870s and beyond, and the fairly sudden erosion of health among Plains Aboriginal peoples. And certainly the destruction of the bison economy was the significant environmental disaster. But my research suggests that the Aboriginal leadership in this era was well aware of the loss of the bison economy, which actually prompted them to seek treaties with the state. So I suggest that the erosion of health had little or less to do with that issue per se, and more to do with the inability of the people to adapt to the new agricultural frontier due to the repressive state policies, the Indian Act, and informal restraints on people's movement and economic development.
And Jocelyn, you have a new book out. Can you tell listeners a little bit about your research?
Sure thing. My research focuses on Aboriginal newcomer land relationships. So my book that's just out is about Temagami, Ontario, and I'm starting a new project that looks at somewhat similar dynamics in Newfoundland. So it explores the histories and power relations through which certain spaces came to be imagined and treated as white, as Canadian, and as natural spaces as opposed to cultural spaces, even as Aboriginal peoples articulated and continue to express very different understandings of such places. And I guess as it's about health, I think that it doesn't really talk about health the way that we kind of generally understand health, or perhaps the way that health is represented in the media as being kind of specific health issues. Mm-hmm. But more directly, it starts with the understanding that health is an environmental issue. And so the access to land, which has been denied to Aboriginal communities through colonial processes that Maureen's talking about, is necessary to the health of communities and individuals. So I have this quote from Jeanette Armstrong that I really like from her book Slash that comes to my mind a lot when I think about this, and so just say a little piece of it, which is, it's hard to show just how much our pride, our culture, and our lives have the roots in the land. It's not easy to explain that to protect and attempt to regain control over it is really the way to protect our own lives as Indian people.
That's fantastic. And Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about where your research intersects with health and environmental issues, or health or environmental issues in Aboriginal history?
So my first research project looked at kind of the encounters in Western Canada between women, First Nations, and newcomers regarding health encounters. But my new research project is looking at issues of food sovereignty in northwestern Ontario, particularly Anishinaabe Aski Nation. And so I'm looking at the policies of the Hudson's Bay Company. I'm looking at traditional land use and knowledge. And in particular, I'm focusing on the Northern Store.
Well, why don't we stay in Ontario and ask Brittany about her work?
Thank you, Sean. I examine hydroelectric development in the Treaty 3 District, which is in northwestern Ontario and southeastern Manitoba. I'm really interested in the post-World War II era. And I'm looking at Anishinaabe people's changing relationship to the capital economy. Much of the literature to date I found assumes that First Nations are at loggerheads with modernity, which when we really break it down is become the story of people unable to adjust to an evolving market economy when subsistence activities are no longer viable on the landscape. And I'm really working to pull out a universal bottom line to show people that this is about business negotiations gone wrong. I'm interested in looking at how First Nations people were outmaneuvered, and because of an inability to participate equally in these negotiations, despite activism and attempts to do so, has left people unable to control both their environments and sort of, by extent, their health.
And these are issues we're definitely going to circle back to in our conversation here today. Leanne, can you tell us a little bit about where your work intersects with health and or environmental issues?
Sure. My work looks at the effects of the Cold War uranium industry on the Serpent River First Nation, which is on the north shore of Lake Huron in Ontario. And as a result of uranium extraction in this area on Anishinaabe territory, there were tremendous health and environmental effects on the river system, as well as issues having to do with occupational health and safety for those Aboriginal, usually men, who participated in the wage economy in these areas. Part of what I'm interested in, along with how food resources changed, how perceptions of the safety of the water and related resources, how that changed over time, particularly as the uranium industry sort of waxed and waned over time. But I'm also interested in how the political leadership and tactics changed over time in this post-war period, and what the legacies of the industry were. What I find really interesting about this, and what has led to my more recent research in looking at the politicization of Aboriginal women in this period, is that some of the formal leadership in the form of chief and council, some of the most active participants in addressing these issues in the community were women, and some of the reasons why that came about.
And finally, Stacy, can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Absolutely. My research is still in early days a bit, but I'm looking at the legacy of the fur trade in the Columbia River Plateau and how it is or isn't remembered by different communities, in interior Salish-speaking communities and non-Indigenous communities, and why it is or isn't remembered. And environmental issues are a big part of my research. There are dozens of hydroelectric dams on the Columbia and its tributaries, as well as a former nuclear production complex. And I'm finding that the ways, and actually as Leanne mentioned, there are uranium mines as well, both on Indigenous reservation land and off, that have in the past employed Indigenous workers. And I'm finding that the ways that people think about both economic development and stewardship are informing their understandings of local history. And that's coming out in state and federal park interpretation and in educational curriculum. And so I'm trying to kind of tease out how that's happening and the ways that these environmental issues inform understandings of the fur trade history in the area.
So we have a really diverse array of expertise here, but I think it's clear that each of your individual research interests has some intersection with one another. And I'm really glad to have this collective of scholars who have such a wide range of expertise and a number of questions relating to health and environmental issues in Aboriginal history in Canada. So maybe I can throw out a really big question for the group to get us started. based on your research and your teaching background in history of Aboriginal peoples in Canada, what do you think have been the most significant changes in pre- or post-Confederation Canadian history for the health of Aboriginal peoples? And I'll leave that up to whoever wants to take a first crack at it.
Well, I can address that. It seems to me that reordering of the landscape and the exclusion of Aboriginal peoples from resources seems to be, fundamental and ongoing issue. A brief example of the subtle and not so subtle forms it took. There's nothing subtle about the CPR mainline, as it was constructed through the Rockies. Mm-hmm. And at Siding 29, construction crews discovered the cave and basin hot springs at Banff. And Dr. R.G. Brett, who was a physician for the CPR, recognized the opportunity and quickly established a private sanatorium mm-hmm. where wealthy tourists could come to enjoy the clear mountain air and the healing waters. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the CPR gladly delivered them to his door. And in a fine bit of medical hucksterism, Brett adorned the walkways to the hot springs with canes and crutches, apparently thrown off by the recently cured. but, of course, the whole region was used by the Stoney or Nakota people and the Sutina or the Sarsi as hunting, gathering grounds, and, of course, the waters, the hot springs, what Chief John Snow called the sacred mountains. Mm-hmm. And so you can talk kind of about the colonization of health as the people's health eroded because their hunting grounds, their spiritual and medical places were colonized by newcomers. And, of course, this becomes a national park. And as it does, hunting is further restricted, mm-hmm. And the people are further isolated on their reserves. So these lines on the landscape, redrawing spaces of health, seems to me one of the fundamental changes, at least.
Jocelyn, this sounds like something you were touching on in your initial remarks about the linkages between land and health in Aboriginal history.
Yeah, I guess when you asked the question this time, the thing that really jumped to my mind was the division of lands with Confederation between the federal government and the provincial governments, which then resulted in very different things in different places. So, for example, national parks, but also, I guess more broadly, the giving of land rights to provincial government so that the provinces had control of lands and resources, and then obviously a big investment in being able to access those lands and resources. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of that with Aboriginal peoples being very much separated from their lands through the idea that they could be managed by the federal government, mm-hmm. separate from the territories, which then became provincial jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So I guess for the Temagami project that I did, that separation was huge, not just for the way that, because of the way that it separated people from their territories through legislation, mm-hmm. but also one effect of that being fights between the provincial and federal governments over what land should be set aside, in this case for the Temiagma Anishinaabe. So, and really the idea from Confederation was that, oh yes, the lands, that the federal government would look after the interests of First Nations, but of course they didn't really. And then the provincial government was so invested in developing the land that it wanted to refuse any kind of new addition to Aboriginal lands, for example, for people who had been excluded from treaties and so on. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of Temagami, there was, it's still an ongoing battle, so 130 years plus later, mm-hmm. the provincial and federal governments still can't get it together to agree that the First Nation is owed land. In the end, this is what it comes down to, right, is a battle over land, who has the right to it, who has the right to live in certain senses. and but then that it gets so complicated by various levels of law and policy and who's in charge of what, and it sort of turns into a bit of a passing the buck game, it seems.
Leanne, what do you think in this big question about the most significant changes in pre- or post-Confederation Canadian history for the health of Aboriginal peoples?
Passing the buck, or as one of my my interview participants had said, we were just like a football, sort of being passed back and forth between these governments. Talking about the ways in which this jurisdictional question comes up fairly often when we're talking about Aboriginal issues in this country. And for my own research, what has struck me was as the development of mining around Elliott Lake in Northern Ontario was very much part of a tripartite relationship between the federal, provincial, and governments, as well as the mining companies themselves. The First Nations communities in the area obviously falling under federal jurisdiction at this time, but having to deal then with bodies like the Ontario Water Resources Commission and other provincial bodies like that, the Lands and Resources, for instance. And what came up fairly frighteningly in my research was the fact that while the province had lower tolerances for the number of pekokiris in the water, the federal government had higher ones, and so there came to be, you know, a very real and a very dangerous difference between whether or not settlers then could be more protected by the provincial bodies that controlled water than the federal government, who was responsible to ensure the safety of First Nations people. So this was something that comes up again and again, as I mentioned, but in very real and very disconcerting ways.
And Kristen, what do you think in terms of significant changes in Aboriginal history, in terms of the health of Aboriginal peoples, either before or after Confederation?
Well, and I think all of what this ties together is, you know, access to land and access to kind of traditional knowledge and food use and health, right? And I think health and the kind of access to, you know, accessible, nutritious food is probably kind of the basis of all of this, right? Clean water. And the federal government and the provincial governments are hand in hand, and I think in a lot of cases, about failing to provide, particularly for remote communities, access to food. And when development takes place, things like, you know, they may consider fish and fur, but they don't consider gathering resources, right? And so there's a real kind of I think discrepancy, if you will, about what constitutes development and whose development and who owns those rights to that land. And it flows through everything that we're talking here.
And this seems to be a common theme here, so maybe it's appropriate to leapfrog in my little question list and ask you about the role that the federal government in Canada has played in issues relating to health and environment among Aboriginal peoples of Canada. And we might even too talk about provincial governments, because several of you have now suggested that there's sort of jurisdictional conflict or overlap after 1867. Some of the provinces have power over their own lands and resources, whereas the federal government is responsible for administering Aboriginal people as wards of the state. So could we talk a little bit about the role of government in shaping some of this history and some of the histories that you've looked at?
Well, I think everyone's pointed out here that the biggest problem is the way in which the British North American Act was constituted, right? That, you know, responsibilities for health care, responsibilities for hunting rights, you know, land use, all of that went to the provinces. And then, you know, Aboriginal people become wards of the state, of the federal state. And so, but these individuals still have all of these concerns. Mm-hmm. And so who's the responsible for taking care of them or paying for them? And, I mean, you see it being played out on the bodies of Aboriginal people in today, where you have, you know, issues in Pikangikum or Keshechewan, where there's, you know, how many communities are without clean water, and the federal government refuses to take responsibility for that because it's a provincial jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, when Keshechewan needed to be evacuated, the federal government refused to take responsibility, and the provincial government refused to take responsibility because neither of them could say who would pay for it. And so First Nations people get lost in this kind of gray area where no one wants to take responsibility, and every other citizen, you know, has has a jurisdiction that takes responsibility for them. I mean, look in 2007, 2008, when they had to pass Jordan's principle, which meant that, does everybody know what Jordan's principle is?
You can explain it for listeners.
Sorry, Jordan's principle, essentially, a young man was born in, I think it was Saskatchewan or Manitoba, I can never remember, and essentially he was born with a chronic congenitive disease and he would die. But and he could live in his home community as long as someone would pick up home care. And this is normal for every other Canadian citizen who is non-Aboriginal. Automatically, the provincial government picks up, you know, paying for home care for children or people in their homes that need it. Unfortunately, for Jordan, neither the provincial or the federal government would take responsibility for that. And he spent 7 years of his life in institutional care when he could have easily gone home and been cared for by his family with a little additional help. And he died in the hospital because no jurisdiction wanted to deal with it or would agree to deal with it. And so what happens is that people get caught up in these kind of bureaucratic webs and health suffers dramatically as responsibility. And so the federal government has passed what is called Jordan's Principle. And basically what they guarantee is that First Nations children get access to the same sorts of health care that is paid for by the governments for every other child automatically. Hmm. And that they
Oh, I was going to say, I just want to jump in here, but I'll let you finish your thought before I do.
Oh, no, sorry, I was pretty much finished.
Go ahead, Brittany.
I was just going to say, you know, about Jordan's principle and speaking to sort of federal policy, nursing stations on reservation today are consistently underfunded, mm-hmm. and First Nations people are not offered the best drugs. The Health Canada formulary for reserve covers suboptimal medicines. Nurses are really limited today in what they can prescribe on reserve. So we're you know, ghettoizing in terms of you know, the medicines we're willing to provide First Nations even further. So, you know, for the longest time, nurses could not subscribe Lancet to people with diabetes on reservation, and this has been the gold standard insulin for almost a decade. It was only approved by the Health Canada formulary for First Nations people in around 2010 or 2011. First Nations girls today, under the funding program for First Nations status girls, are really limited in terms of the sort of birth control they have access to. So nurses on reserve can approve the shot or they can approve the pill, but they can't give the patch. You know, even in dental care, cutbacks and sort of this budget issue has really affected people in their health. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, you could get one crown every 2 years. Then it changed to two crowns every 5 years. And now to get a crown, you have to be pre-approved. So my uncle recently asked to get pre-approved for a crown, and they said because he could still chew on one side of his mouth, they weren't going to approve it. So, these budget issues are just, you know, really, really upsetting, and this Health Canada formulary is so, so unjust, and I think it's penalizing people who could use, you know.
Well, I think what people don't recognize is that the per capita funding for healthcare has been frozen since the early 90s on First Nations reserves, right? So while the cost of living and the cost of healthcare has increased, the amount that's being paid for by the federal government has stayed the same since the early 90s.
Now, if we dig a little bit deeper into the past, let's say to the late 19th century and the early decades of the 20th century, for example, in Maureen's work in Medicine That Walks, Maureen, can you tell us a little bit about the way in which federal policy affected Aboriginal health in a much earlier period in Canadian history?
Yeah, Sean, the Department of Indian Affairs employed physicians, and very often this was an opportunity for a physician to get work in burgeoning settler communities where there weren't, frankly, enough sick people to maintain a practice. Mm-hmm. So what they called the Indian work really helped establish them in communities. But their role fundamentally was to keep an eye on any kind of epidemic to make sure it didn't cross these reserve boundaries, mm-hmm. to keep it confined to reserve. And on reserves, very often, missionaries establish kind of rudimentary hospitals to provide care. But the federal government fundamentally did not want to be in the healthcare business at all.
Right.
My more recent work on these so-called Indian hospitals in Canada developed in the 1940s and 50s, and these were state-run, racially segregated healthcare for Aboriginal people. And the contradictions that we still, Aboriginal communities still live with, many of them were set down at this era because they were established to treat what was called Indian tuberculosis in the 1940s and 50s when it was seen as a threat to non-Aboriginal citizens. And so they were to be isolated in these hospitals. The other factor in their establishment was to remove Aboriginal people from community hospitals because the cost of hospital care was skyrocketing in the post-war period. Mm. And the federal government understood that they could provide care at what they deemed half the cost of community hospitals. So you have isolation hospitals for tuberculosis that are actually general hospitals for all conditions. The opportunities for cross-infection were rampant.
So this is bringing a question to my mind, too, that some listeners might have, but why is it historically that the federal government of Canada has a responsibility for health policy for Aboriginal people?
Well, because of... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, it's just to do with the division of powers that I was talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And so, Indian Affairs, and I'm sort of surprised that we haven't said the word Indian Act yet, so I'll say it. Indian Act! So the federal government became in charge of Indians and lands reserved for Indians, and Indian lives were governed under the Indian Act.
And this is status Indians, the legal definition under the British North America Act and the Indian Act, 1867, 1876.
Yes,
okay.
Which is...
But
yes.
The definition of who was and who was not an Indian was passed much earlier in the 1840s and 1850s.
Okay.
Yes.
And has continued to change, particularly along the lines of gender, which has been a huge mm-hmm. issue, right? So that Aboriginal women who married non-Aboriginal men would lose their status and their children would not have status. So people like Benita Lawrence have talked about, lost... Mm-hmm. Aboriginal people who have fallen through the wayside about then who can be recognized. And I think this is a really, important and important issue to consider, particularly in the history of the creation of Indians, because the Indian Act then gave itself, the federal government gave itself the power to define who counted as an Indian.
Right.
And to count as an Indian, Aboriginal people could define their own identities as much as they wanted, but the services that we're talking about mm-hmm. As poor as they often are tied to being defined as an Indian. And so the Newfoundland example, I think, is kind of interesting in this regard because when Newfoundland joined Confederation, of course, much later than anywhere else, then there was no recognition of any Aboriginal people in Newfoundland and Labrador. And so, but of course, there are many Aboriginal groups there. So the Mi'kmaq on the actual island of Newfoundland only recently were recognized by the federal government as Indigenous. And it's interesting to see that since Confederation for Newfoundland, then Indigenous groups have been struggling to be recognized under the Indian Act. So mm-hmm. as flawed as the Act is, then that it has become an important, though also contested, definition of Aboriginality. I don't know how to convey, just the significance and the, I don't even know the word to say, of the Indian Act and its impact and legacies in all sorts of different areas, like every area of indigenous life, it seems to me.
So there's certainly a constitutional responsibility on the part of the federal government and then defined in the Indian Act. But can anyone tell us a little bit more about what kind of treaty obligations the federal government holds in terms of responsibility for Aboriginal health? Go ahead, Leanne.
Perhaps others can add on once I'm finished, but quite simply, in Treaty 6, the medicine chest is one of the responsibilities of the government, and it was also made in many of the verbal oral promises that went along in treaty negotiations and other areas of the numbered treaties.
Well, I think in some ways it's also implied too, in the sense that, you know, they promised to provide both the kind of the tools and the skills, like education regarding farming and kind of transferring lifestyles, particularly in Western Canada, that they were going to ensure a particular standard of health. And to me, that's implied when you're saying that you're going to help people, or you're going to ensure that people are able to kind of provide for themselves while you're removing all of their and stealing all of their other resources. There's an implied, you know, to me an implicit agreement that you're going to monitor their health and ensure that they're able to, you know, provide for themselves.
You know, when I think of the medicine, chest clause, I have to say, you know, I think that's about, you know, creating access to new medicines and new expertise. And I have to say, you know, about that implicit nature that you just mentioned, I don't think anyone really signing on to treaty would have anticipated that, you know, in the 1880s and 1890s with the banning of the potluck, that traditional medicines and traditional healing practices would be so restricted. You know, I don't think anyone really anticipated, you know, when they were going into these negotiations, you know, with the pipe and with goodwill and great intentions, that, you know, there would be extreme RCMP surveillance.
I think part of that is the fact that, you know, when they're negotiating these treaties, they're not telling anybody, and they're doing it after the consolidation of the Indian Act in 1876. They're not telling anybody about the Indian Act. They're not telling anybody about the restrictions and the power that they have under this other basis of legislation while they're negotiating these treaties. And it's just kind of corrupt and really criminal acts on the part of the federal government in failing to kind of inform and provide real consent or information regarding, you know, informed consent that leads to these problems, right, that produces these problems.
Maureen, could you tell us a little bit more specifically about these medicine chest clauses in some of the numbered treaties?
Well, John, the medicine chest clause, if I'm not mistaken, was raised by the Aboriginal negotiators at Treaty 6. And I know that Arthur Ray and Jim Miller and Frank Tufts, Bounty and Benevolence, they make the link between treaty negotiations and former, at least among former fur trade partners, they make the link that there are, you know, these similarities. And there was, in the fur trade era, I think, at least in Western Canada, a certain sharing of medicines, and it wasn't all one way. So the medicine chest clause comes to the treaty negotiations from the Aboriginal negotiators, and it's accepted kind of reluctantly by government negotiators. But there was also, at the end of the numbered treaty negotiations, kind of a blanket assurance on the part of the federal government, if not Alexander Morris, that the terms of all the treaties would apply to all the people, that they didn't, separate, well, this treaty had this promise, but that one didn't. So there was kind of this reassurance. And I think for a very long time, because of the existence of these physicians on reserve and at treaty time in particular, it reinforced the notion in people's minds that, yes, healthcare was a treaty right.
Now, this maybe it's time we should shift gears a little bit to think about land and resources a little bit more. So I just wanted to ask Stacey if, in her research, she's looked at the way in which the relationship between Aboriginal people and the environment has changed at all since European colonization or since the interactions between Indigenous peoples and Europeans during the fur trade. Stacey?
Sure, absolutely. It has, I think the relationship between Indigenous people in the Columbia River Basin and the environment has changed in a number of ways. The community I work most closely with is the Spokane community, and there's a history of uranium mining on the Spokane Reservation. And so far it's been really interesting to meet with people and talk about this history of uranium mining on the reservation and the notion that Spokane people were removed to this reservation that was beyond their traditional homeland, and that there was a bit of a separation between the uranium mining and the land itself in thinking of it as a homeland, because they were in a place that didn't have the same meaning for them as lands closer to the river and closer to what is now downtown Spokane. And again, I'm very early in my research, so I haven't been able to explore that as far as I plan to. But I'm also switching regional gears a little bit. In previous research for this podcast, I found that in recent years, climate change in the north in Canada has changed the relationship between Aboriginal people and the land in the sense that warmer temperatures in the north are meaning that ice is thinner and it's breaking up earlier and faster. And this means that hunting seasonal harvest times are changing and seasonal harvesting behaviors are changing. And also new insects carrying new diseases are coming to Indigenous communities in the north. And most importantly, though, I think in interviews and studies with these northern Indigenous communities, there's this conveyance of a real sense of finding ways, Indigenous communities finding ways to work and live around these changes. So these significant changes are occurring to the landscape, and they're affecting Aboriginal health and economies. And so communities are adapting and finding ways to work with them and work around them.
Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting connection, I think, to Brittany's work. Brittany, could you talk a little bit about the ways in which hydroelectric development as a kind of industrial resource extractive activity has had an impact on the relationship between Aboriginal peoples and the environment in your case study?
Absolutely. One of the most recent chapters I completed and I presented this summer in Connecticut had to do with the creation of reservoirs and what happens when we turn rapids or flowing waters into still waters when we don't consider in developing electricity the disposal of our human waste. And I found that, Kenora expanded exponentially as soon as we had this power potential and we could expand the mill and there were more jobs and then all of a sudden there were more houses. But no one really considered the changes in river flows. So all this excess human waste and also wood cellulose fiber from the mill got dumped directly into this river and then just sat right in front of Dolls 38C or Ochichagwe Babigoni First Nations Reserve. And it meant that people were no longer able to consume their water and it led to the complete abandonment of the community by the late 1970s because people were getting sick all the time. I mean, there were cases of awful diarrhea, a lot of Guardia lambia, which is a parasite in stool samples. It was a real tragedy. Just speaking on what Stacey was saying, I wanted to pick up about new insects and diseases and things moving in with sort of changes to the landscape. One of the examples that was shared with me recently by an elder, and Sean, this doesn't have to do with hydroelectric development, but it has to do with clear cutting. As clear cutting in the south has had to move north towards the district, a lot more deer have moved north. And why that's happening, I was told, was that because the saplings that spring up once the lands are cleared are easier for the deer to eat. So, they're following the clear cut because they want this easy, easy kind of deer salad for them, you know. Mm-hmm. They want to munch on those young shoots. And they've brought with them an ear mite that's not fatal to the deer, but it's resulted in a near collapse of the moose population in the Kenora District. Mm-hmm. So.
And Leanne, mm-hmm. do you see intersections with your own work on the role that industrial resource extraction has played in shaping the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the environment?
Absolutely. In the expertise elders have shared with me, one of the most clear instances that they saw in terms of the threatening of our resources in our territory is the fact that in some of the most polluted areas, the fish quality, for example, was in sharp decline.
Right.
Also, they've talked about, you know, the beaver quality being in sharp decline, both in terms of being able to consume it, but also to be able to trap it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's tied to this as well is there's a situation where the Indigenous knowledge, I think, becomes compromised in some ways in that, this is what I mean by that. In some cases, some of the things that had been familiar to people, the familiar ways to recognize when something was not healthy, was challenged by the fact that this was radiological pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is in some cases when, for instance, my grandmother shared with me that in one of our interviews that where the bay where an acid plant had been constructed because sulfuric acid was used in the production of uranium, in the bay where that was, it was quite clear that that it was polluted and that it was probably not a safe place for children to be swimming.
Mm-hmm.
So what she did with her children was she brought them to an area where they could swim in the river. Now, what she didn't know at the time was there was refuse from some of the mines from damage to dams that had gone on in that area. And so while the river looked clean and it smelled clean and you couldn't really tell without testing,
mm-hmm.
that it had been compromised. She had actually, you know, when she found out about it later on, it was something that she reflected on, and it was something that actually really bothered her, not surprisingly, because of this whole situation. And one of the sort of related to this change over time is the observations that some scholars like Paul Nadsity have made in that Aboriginal peoples, especially leadership, have had to sort of adopt a new bureaucratic language in order to deal with these issues in a meaningful way. And that sort of ties back to our conversation before the taping started. But
mm-hmm.
But a lot of these reports, for instance, are written in a very particular manner that doesn't necessarily reflect the ways in which traditional knowledge is usually communicated. So those are some of the changes that I saw with my own community and with my own research.
Now, I think this is what's really important about the work that each of you are doing in this historical research, but is it too much to say that this is, in some sense, for Canadian history, the untold story of the Staples thesis? That we have a history of industrial exploitation of natural resources that's actually, in many of the case studies you've suggested, had profound impacts on Indigenous peoples. And is this a function of not thinking about Canadian history within a colonial context?
Well, I guess it's a very different way of thinking about colonialism. I think the way that I was taught about colonialism in school is certainly a colonial story, but it's the story of Europeans moving from one place to another place where they extract resources, and then exactly as you say, the Staples story of what are the problems then for settlers of an economy based on the export of raw goods for the European market.
Right.
So yeah, I had never thought about it before like that, but I think this is definitely there's a way of thinking about this story, because I've been thinking as we've been talking that the two main themes about how the relationships between Aboriginal peoples and the environment has changed is that, number one, they have a lot less access to their territories because of colonialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about hydro development, private property, railway lines, all of these things that have disrupted traditional, you know, food and medicine gathering practices, but just also life on land
mm-hmm.
in general. And then secondly, that the lands and waters have been degraded as a result of these colonial thing. So I think it is an interesting way of thinking about it as kind of the hidden half of the Staples thesis, always there, but not something that is, I guess, talked about it. But that, yeah, I mean, it's the profound result of such an economy.
Maybe this is a way to connect to Kristen's more recent research on food security. Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at in terms of Aboriginal food security?
So one of the pieces that we're looking at right now is we're trying to map people's perceptions of the land, right? And so what is happening, particularly with development and clear cutting here in the north, is there's a lot of spraying. Mm-hmm. And so we're concerned with not necessarily just, fish and fur-bearing animals, but we're also concerned with, gathering processes. And so we're finding that perceptions of people have very kind of clear perceptions of what the land is and what they can use based on where people are spraying. So they're actually being told that, they think that if a place gets sprayed, that they can't use it ever again. Mm-hmm. And so people are actually stopping the use of particular areas, i.e. blueberry picking or whatever, because they've seen that it's been sprayed by a particular company that's come in and clear cut or for whatever reason they're spraying, right? And so there's reasons. It's not only just kind of this physical reshaping of the land, but there's also this kind of epistemological reshaping of the land that I think that is taking place, mm-hmm. That is dramatically changing the landscape too.
So why don't we take go ahead, Maureen.
Sean, it was me. It was Brittany. I just wanted to jump on what Kristen was saying there about, this idea that certain plants can't be harvested once they've been sprayed. And one of the things that I found in my interviews and some of the transcripts I've reviewed as well is this idea that medicine plants are things that you can't, You can't go out and plant them. So, we can clear cut and then we can have a bunch of, tree planters come in and regrow evergreens. And there's this idea, a more Western framework that we can replenish to some extent what we take. Mm-hmm. But with some of the traditional healers that I've been working with, medicines that were flooded out, you can't just go replant. You can't go replant those medicines because they don't have the same power or the same value once they've been lost. You have to find them sort of naturally occurring, and that's what makes a powerful medicine plant.
Well, maybe this is a good moment for us to talk a little bit about methodology in researching Aboriginal history. A common critique of government and academic discussions of Aboriginal health and environmental issues is that there's a lack of Indigenous voices in proposed solutions which can perpetuate colonial frameworks. So maybe, Stacey, if you could start us off here telling us a little bit about the ways in which historians can respond to this critique while meaningfully contributing to discussions of Aboriginal health and environmental issues.
Sure, absolutely. I think first of all, on a very basic level, we really need to openly recognize our role as historians or as academics and our relationship with the communities with which we're working. But I think we also need to respectfully honor those relationships with Indigenous partners in our research through asking what our partner communities want, what's important to them, what are their interests in our work, obviously. And also follow through with that. If we're given the trust, we need to make good on it. And I think another way that we can implement, really put some of our work to use is perhaps trying to find ways to get a historical context inserted, I guess, into some of these federal governmental reports. There's a lot of study and report generation that comes out of the Canadian federal government. Statistics Canada puts out a lot of reports, and unfortunately, I think the ones I've read so far in Aboriginal health have very narrow fields of view and lack a historical background that could contextualize their findings. And I think, perhaps give a fuller picture of what's happening in Aboriginal communities, but also try to put our research to work as a tool for the communities for which we work or with whom we work.
And Brittany, this issue, I think, came up for you in our conversations before the interview when I invited you to be on the panel. You asked me, do you want me to be a member of the community or a historian?
Yeah, Yeah, I did ask you that.
So how do you deal with this then, right? So you're doing research on as a historical researcher, but you're also a member of an Aboriginal community.
So, Sean, when you asked me, or when I asked you whether or not I should be participating as a scholar or, you know, a community member, for me it was really a question about how much I should be immersing myself in the secondary literature, mm-hmm. in conversations within the institution and amongst our peers, versus how much I should be, you know, engaging with issues that have really come to matter on the ground. And I found that sometimes those issues don't always really connect. So I think as academics, we need to start making an effort to immerse ourselves as much in the secondary literature, mm-hmm. as in the community. And, you know, for me, this divide became evident this summer when I went to do my field research. I had engaged in a lot of secondary literature on, you know, appropriate methodologies. I had gone through the ethics review process and felt really prepared. I felt like, you know, I was an expert ready to hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. And I walked into the community and I presented my project at a band meeting. And the first thing the chief did was set me up with an elder guide, because she felt that the issues I was addressing were going to have real interesting health consequences that I hadn't even thought about or imagined for the people I was working with. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, not presenting ourselves as learners as well, you know, taking a step back from the position of experts and seeing ourselves, you know, perhaps more as mediums or people who can reflect a certain perspective but aren't authorities on it, you know. I've been so blessed in being able to observe and being welcomed into people's homes. And I'm growing all the time.
Yeah. Does anybody else want to jump in to address this question about how we integrate Indigenous voices into our research to avoid perpetuating colonial frameworks?
Do you mind if I?
Go ahead, Kristen.
This is Kristen. So I think part of it is, I think we have to really, as academics and historians, think about what the end result is, right? So what is the purpose of our research? Are we doing it because we want to have X number of publications and we want to become an associate professor and we want to get tenure? Or is it because we're actually truly concerned with the conditions that are taking place in these communities, right? Is it about building capacity in these communities for them to kind of be able to challenge these kind of colonial frameworks under which they kind of operate on, like the weight of the colonial apparatus? And so, for example, if you look at things like land use planning, right? So in order for First Nations to actually meet First Nations communities to meet government's demands on them regarding development in their communities, they have to pay. They have to come up with a cost for land use planning. And these costs are enormous. I mean, even just to get going, it's like $20,000. Mm-hmm. And these are already kind of resource-strapped communities to begin with. And so, you know, I think a lot of universities have access to funding and researchers and skills and knowledge that, you know, that we actually get paid to do, and then we go out and do our research, right? And so I think that there's a way in which we need to acknowledge that if we do this research, that it might just stay in that community, and they get to choose what to do with it. And we are not the people who are, you know, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're going to publish. And I think there's a real problem is all these, you know, research partnerships that get built up between communities and universities, and most of the money goes to the university, and none of the money goes to these communities. And yet they're the objects of research, right? This research wouldn't exist, mm-hmm. if we didn't make them into objects, right? And so I think there's a real problem. And there's a real industry, particularly at universities right now, trying to kind of hop on the Aboriginal research train, right? Because there is a lot of money being put into it, but a lot of that money is just being funneled back into universities and about development, and not the kind of development that actually is community development. It's economic development that's going to help industry and not people living in these areas. So yeah, I think we need to figure about, and I think it's a problem because as academics in institutions, we're kind of, you know, we have to have X number of publications, right? We have to have these kind of slots on our CV, and, you know, that's how we maintain our jobs. Mm-hmm. But I think research in First Nations community, we need to detach that.
And Leanne, how do you contend with these issues in your work?
Well, it's something that I have sort of reflected on, both being a community member and an historian sort of in the same sort of parish or publisher parish environment as well. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of sort of this discussion, what I found interesting was the fact that we were talking about fairly, in some cases, narrow views of what constitutes environment and what constitutes health. And what I was struck by was the fact that as I was preparing, it was sometimes difficult to separate some of the things that I was seeing, trying to narrow it down versus seeing health and wellness as being sort of the definition that I had grown up with, right. Which ties all of these things together. But I think this also speaks to some of the programming issues that happens where there, you know, there's an existing program for certain issues in communities, but they sometimes are earmarked not for a more holistic view of how to go about these issues, but for one very particular program, like an anti-smoking program or something mm-hmm. like that. And so I think if we can introduce more holistic views of what these issues are, what their roots are, involve elders in some of these programs, in designing some of these programs and implementing them, I think we could do a much better job.
And Maureen, do you feel this tension at all in your role as an academic researcher with the potential for perpetuating a colonial framework in the way you approach your work?
Well, certainly, and I think as academics, we've got a lot to answer for, unfortunately. But
we have our own history, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, in a general sense, I think we would do well to listen to treaty elders who insisted that the treaties were actually promises to share the land with newcomers. And, I mean, evidence for that was, you know, quite abundant on the prairies in the early treaty period, where Aboriginal midwives and healers aided settlers who had, you know, arrived shockingly without their own medicines, you know, and really helped these early settlers. And the other part of that too is that we have to understand that it was not just First Nations people who signed treaties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are all treaty people when we live in Canada, and I know that the courts today, for instance, have imposed a duty to consult First Nations on projects that affect their lands. But whether that, you know, has teeth or not, I don't know. But, I mean, it is important to remember that two sides signed the treaties, and only one side seems to be living with them.
And, Jocelyn, I want to give you a chance to jump in here on this this matter.
Thanks, Sean. I guess I'm thinking a lot about what everyone has said, and particularly what Brittany said really resonates with me. And I guess more and more I've been thinking of myself as a learner and realizing how much I have to learn. So I'm going to sort of switch positions between, I guess, teacher, researcher, learner, I don't know. but so as a non-Aboriginal scholar and citizen, then I feel that it's my duty to talk about colonialism in Canada mm-hmm. because it's something that is not addressed properly in schools. And I see that all the time with my students, with really just stereotypes that are perpetuated and that are powerful because I think that they make people closed to the possibility of making real change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that understanding our shared history, understanding what it means when people say we are all treaty people, you know, even understanding a simple phrase like we need to understand our past in order not to repeat it, like which is what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is premised on, then I guess that's where I feel my obligation comes from. That said, I think that there's a very big difference between speaking about colonialism and speaking on behalf of Aboriginal individuals and communities
mm-hmm.
who have no trouble expressing themselves. I think the question is about how and whether these concerns are being heard, the ways in which they're being addressed, and I think Leanne pointed to that really well with, you know, the narrowing of programs, and even the ways in which funding can perpetuate some of the same stereotypes. So you can have funding to do an anti-violence prevention initiative, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of supports the idea that Aboriginal communities are quote-unquote violent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is very different than supporting what we might call holistic understanding of health or environment, and understanding colonialism as fundamentally an unhealthy system that needs to be addressed at its root. Mm-hmm. And also, this is kind of something that I think, Sean, when you asked the question to Brittany right away, sort of blew up this stereotype. But I noticed that this sometimes happens, even at a conference I was at recently, mm-hmm. that there's a tendency to talk about Aboriginal people kind of on the one hand and academics on the other hand, mm-hmm. as if these groups were mutually exclusive, which is certainly not the case, and I think this panel points to really clearly. But it's a kind of strange question, and I guess part of these things are asking us to reflect upon the questions that we ask and the ways in which we think about different groups of people, you know, and even ourselves as what am I in this moment, you know, what kind of subject position do I take up when I teach or when I learn or when I, you know, talk to community members or whatever. So I guess part of it is being reflective, whoever you are, wherever you stand, which will also change over time. Mm-hmm. And I guess asking some of those hard questions about, yeah, why you're doing what you're doing, and having a good answer for that, I guess.
Well, I think as we found with these roundtables, we never fully cover the topics that we attempt to cover, but we certainly open up many more questions. And I think this panel especially has really illustrated the importance of bringing together historians of health and historians of the environment. And most importantly, I think, for Canadian environmental historians, really driving home the point that the environmental histories we write about and the way in which we look at the histories of environmental issues all take place within a colonial context that have had profound impacts for peoples across the country. I want to thank each of you for joining us here on this roundtable, which I think was extraordinary. Thank you, Leanne. Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Jocelyn. Thank you, Stacy. And thank you, Brittany.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you for joining us.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the Network in Canadian History and Environment, the Robart Centre for Canadian Studies, and Canada's History Magazine. This episode was made by Stacey Nation Knapper, Andrew Watson, Kristen Burnett, Leanne Letty, Brittany Luby, Maureen Lux, Jocelyn Thorpe, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave us comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate and review this podcast on our iTunes page. You can also follow Nature's Past on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you'd like to send me some feedback, you can contact me through my website, seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. To keep up with current work in the field of environmental history, listeners should check out our iOS app, which works on iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. You can get the app at niche-canada.org/envhist. That's ENVHIST. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.